Great. So it's a great pleasure to be here, and I think I really like this discussion sessions setting, because I think that at least I learn much more from the discussions than from the formal talks themselves. So the my title of my talk is really just the bounce in loop quantum cosmology and its implications. And as Stefan and Neil told us, that some questions were sent to the speakers, so I decided basically to structure the talk in terms of these questions, but of course only in the context of loop quantum cosmology. So what does loop quantum cosmology have to say about these questions? Now, some of the things that I'm going to talk about, in fact, quite a lot of things that I'm going to talk about, is really kind of a background material to experts in loop quantum cosmology. It has been around for a long time, but I think many of the points are not really appreciated more generally. And since as the talks go on, the people sort of just assume that everybody knows the basic things and then go on from there. And so I thought that since this is the first talk, I will begin with an introduction which provides a broad picture of what the scenario is, what the thinking is, what the assumptions are, and so on in loop quantum cosmology. So the first question is really, is novel physics required, right? And is new physics required? So the answer to the one and two, and just let me first tell you the answer and then develop. This part is the longest, other parts are shorter. Also, I should say that there are many other talks on loop quantum cosmology or related to loop quantum cosmology. They will follow up on what I'm going to say up here. So this is really a broad introduction. So basically, the answer to the first question is yes, novel physics is required. And that is really quantum nature of Riemannian geometry. So basic premise in loop quantum gravity is that not only are the matter fields basically quantum mechanical, but even the space-time geometry is quantum mechanical from birth, so to say. And therefore, really we need this, and then the question is then, what are the implications of this quantum geometry?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is it Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian?
It's pseudo-Riemannian, but the statement is that the...
Is that important?
In the cosmological context, it's not that important, but in general, it is important, very important. For example, the reason basically is because in mini superspace, you've got some foliation, so it can go back and forth. But in general, it is very important. And in fact, the spin form models are very, very careful about the Lorentzian signature and do things. My general, I hope it is okay that, you know, the short questions like that I will answer. A question that requires a long explanation, I will postpone it to the discussion session, because otherwise I'll be stuck in part, you know, in one sub part of the talk. Okay, so this is the quantum Riemannian geometry. And then the statement is that, so that is a question. And then and that's what I'm going to explain this in a minute. And then the question is about the reciprocally, then what new physics do we learn? And then what we find is that in the context of quantum cosmology, there are sharp results on upper bounds of physical observables, such as density, curvature, and shear, and Hubble parameter, and so we'll discuss that in 1 minute. Okay, so now let me begin up here. So I just step back a little bit, because the idea about the bounds and the idea that, or at least the idea that quantum physics would be important in the early universe goes back to Meissner and then Wheeler and DeWitt, and this theory has been has been talked about a lot. But in this earlier work, almost always, people did not worry about the mathematics was very formal. One wrote down the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, even in the context of cosmology, not only in the full context. One of the things that loop quantum gravity has done is to, even in the full theory, has tried to make that mathematics really well-founded, so that there really are function spaces, there really are Hilbert spaces, there are operators which are self-adjoint, sometimes there are only essentially self-adjoint, and so sometimes they're essentially self-adjoint, sometimes there are many self-adjoint extensions. So all such things have been looked at in some in great detail. So in the olden literature, one often sort of, in the period of weight theory, one often just consider wave functions of, say, for example, the scale factor and some matter field, which typically the convention is just to denote by scalar field, phi. It can be other matter fields up there. It's phi just a... And then one just looked at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is an equation on this, which is really the quantum Hamiltonian constraint. Which says that the Hamiltonian constraint operator operating on this psi is equal to zero. And then one looks at solutions of that. And very often people say, well, singularity is resolved because, for example, the wave function vanishes at psi a equal to zero. Well, that is not really any resolution of singularity, because if you have a real Hilbert space in physics, as you all know, for example, the non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the L2 spaces, the square integral spaces, the functions are really equivalence classes of functions where two are considered to be equivalent if they differ on a set of measures zero. That means I could make psi of zero whatever I wanted. It really doesn't change the physics of this wave function at all, that quantum state at all. So there are other such things. They were sort of really heuristic. Again, in a discussion session, I can go in great detail about various things people have said and why they have remained formal and not very conclusive. So one of the things that one would like to do is the following, that one would like to introduce a Hilbert space structure on the solutions. Right on. And then have operators and then see, in fact, if these operators are bounded or they blow up, etc. So how does one do this? So actually, before developing the loop quantum cosmology program, this was done for Wheeler-DeWitt theory more carefully, to develop Wheeler-DeWitt theory in a more mathematically precise manner. And so what one does is the following. I mean, these ideas go back to people like Chris Isham and so on. Now, what one does is one just says that, well, first you construct a kinematic Hilbert space of some wave functions with some kinematically inner product, which you could, for example, just take to be equal to d phi. A is actually positive, so typically one replaces A with log of A called Z, and then the inner product is generally taken to be d phi. But such that the constraint operator is self-adjoint. Now, if it is a self-adjoint operator, then there's a nice mathematical way to extract, this is a formal way of extracting the solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint, or the constraint up here, and the statement is that given any such kinematical state, you can write down the physical Hilbert space to be just e to the I lambda, e to the lambda times c hat, operating on, let me call this little psi, this is a kinematical Hilbert, this is a physical and this is a kinematical. So you start with some kinematic Hilbert space, start with some wave function there, for example, square integral of phi and a, and then operate on this operator up here. Now the main problem is, so formally this is, if you like, delta of the constraint operator. You can give rigorous meaning for it if c hat is a self-adjoint operator in terms of spectral projections, and it really picks out the kernel of this particular operator. But the problem is typically that this object is, if in fact the group generated, this is a one-parameter family of unitary transformations that are generated by the constraint. If this group generated is compact, then you can do the integral, and this object is again in the kinematic Hilbert space, and we're done. So this is what happens, for example. So this is a compact group. For example, if I take my constraint where if my constraint were just j hat z equal to zero in ordinary quantum mechanics, then just generates rotations and there's a compact group. And then I can start with any kinematical Hilbert space, any kinematical state, integrate this, and I will automatically obtain axisymmetric wave functions, and I can use the same inner product as in the kinematical Hilbert space, and everything is fine. So this is again integrable on H kinematic, H kinematic. You introduce a kinematic Hilbert space such that say hat is self-adjoint on it, and then you obtain the physical states by just doing this integration up here. But in general, this group is not compact. In the Vedder-Debye case, it is not compact. And then the statement is that this object is not normalizable in the kinematic Hilbert space. So if you start with dA dz or dA dA d phi or d log of A d phi in that inner product, the statement is that the solutions are not normalizable. This is a standard thing. And then what do you do? Well, fortunately, there is actually a technique called group averaging. What happens basically is that we are looking at the kernel of this operator. So basically, eigenstates of that operator with zero eigenvalue. And they may not be normalizable if the spectrum of the operator is continuous. They will not be normalizable if the spectrum of the operator is continuous. Nonetheless, there is an idea about this very precise mathematical technique called group averaging, which extracts. So basically, given any, if you want psi 1 physical and psi 2 physical, I'm just telling you the answer, I'm not telling you the reason. But there's a very well-developed mathematics which uses the so-called Galfan theory of rigged Hilbert spaces. Which gives home to these non-normalizable wave functions. And then the statement is that I can define the inner product between two such things, where psi 1 is obtained from one kinematical Hilbert space, psi 1, and psi 2 physically is obtained from another kinematical Hilbert space. This to be we take psi 1 kinematical, and then you take psi 2 kinematical, and take here psi 1 physical. So this is actually integrated like that. This is not normalizable by itself, but it's in a product with some psi 2 in some dense Hilbert space, in some dense subspace, the Hilbert space, is actually normalizable. So the idea up here is that we've got a Hilbert space, kinematical Hilbert space, and then there is a dense subspace, like some function compact support, for example, which actually lie in here. And then the statement is that there's also a subspace which is dual to it, and these objects belong to this space, and they can act on the first space and give you a well-defined answers. This is a general idea. It's a well-defined procedure that you can follow. So this is what we can do for the Vedder-Debye equation, and we can ask, find out what happens. So if you do for the Vedder-Debye equation, now typically this is true for any self-adjoint operator, but unless the operator is sufficiently simple, you cannot do the analytical expression integrals. It exists, but you cannot easily do them. So if you consider the case in which the only scalar field is a massless scalar field, the only matter field is a massless scalar field, then in fact, the Vedder-Debye equation, this procedure can completely implement it, and we find that we got solutions to the Vedder-Debye equation, which are physical states, which satisfy the Vedder-Debye equation. There's inner product on it, so we can ask. And now we can ask a physical question, such as, is it the case that if I consider, for example, rho hat as an operator on this Hilbert space, this, or I can consider the Hubble parameter or something, are these operators bounded on this Hilbert space? And the answer is no, they are not bounded on this Hilbert space. And you can have states in which the energy density is arbitrarily large. So these are typically unbounded operators. And you can even do the following. You can think of the The scalar field phi, because it is monotonic, because satisfies the scalar field, the wave equation. So you can think of the scalar field phi as time, and you can think of the scale factor, or volume is what typically we do in loop quantum cosmology, which goes like A cube, as, and say we would like to see, phi is time, and this is space up here, and we want to know what happens. So the universe classically starts with zero volume and grows, and then we can take a Villard-Devitt state, which is peaked, sharply peaked around some classical trajectory at late times, evolve it back. You can explicitly do it, and then the statement is that when you evolve it back, it actually goes to it follows this trajectory, and it actually goes to the singularity. And so in this simple model, the singularity is not resolved. Now the situation is different for loop quantum cosmology, and one would say why. So in loop quantum cosmology, there are two issues that happen. The first issue is that you get a new kinematic Hilbert space. Compared to the Villard-Devitt theory. And the second thing is, therefore, you have to add new dynamics on this Hilbert space. So why do you get new kinematic Hilbert space? Well, let's go back to loop quantum gravity. In loop quantum gravity, we got in the Villard-Devitt theory, we got the three metric, GAB, and its canonical conjugate momentum, which is like the extrinsic curvature times square root of determinant minus the trace. So that is what we got up here. But in the phase space description of loop quantum gravity, instead the basic variable is a connection. This is a spin connection, which enables you to parallel transport spinners. So basically, if you are given a curve, gamma, you do points, and then you're given a spinner here, then this connection enables you to parallel transport the spinner. It's exactly what happens in Maxwell theory, where the Maxwell connection enables you to parallel transport wave functions of charged particles. And then it's canonical conjugate variable. This is like in Young-Mills theory, and canonical conjugate variables are, you can think of as electric field. But now, they also represent orthonormal triads. So I got these orthonormal triads up here. So the basic variables are very different. The connections and triads up here. And now what happens is the following, which is somewhat surprising. Namely, that you can first of all construct well-defined of the observables without using any background metric. So background independent algebra. And this is given by holonomy. This is the holonomy is the parallel transport operator. There's a path order exponential of the connection. And so this is equal to path order exponential of the connection along this curve gamma up here. And so instead of the connection, we have holonomy. And instead of this is electric field. So you can look at flux of electric field on surfaces. So this is the fluxes. This really is the density of weight 2, so it's really the 2 form. You can integrate on a 2 surface and get a flux. And we've got a holonomy and flux algebra. And it's a Poisson algebra, which is closed, which is very nice. And now what you do is to go to quantum theory, we look for representations of this algebra. So we look for representations. So instead of looking at Q and G and P algebra, we look at this algebra. Representation of this algebra, holonomy flux algebra. And now there is a very powerful theorem due to Lewandowski, Okalau, Salman, and Tiemann. And we call it lost because it took many years for it to be published. It was lost in the middle time, in the meanwhile. There's a lost theorem up here which says that there's a unique representation if you ask Diffie-Marius. Now this is a three-dimensional Diffie-Marius, an answer to Neil's question, because this is a canonical setting, and path integral setting, you'll get something. You'll get the full Riemannian geometry. So there's a unique representation of the algebra. And in this representation, Riemannian geometry, now proper Riemannian geometry, is observables have discrete spectra. So they are purely discrete eigenvalues. Basically, these holonomies of connections, these objects you can think of as being elementary excitations of non-perturbative geometry. Now, if you give me a surface and an excitation, if it intersects it at one, at some point, then this excitation deposits on it one quantum of area. And as a result, you know, you can have many excitations up here, but each one depositing one quantum of area, and therefore, in fact, the eigenvalues of the area operator associated with the surface turn out to be discrete. So this is what happens. Now, when we go to a loop quantum cosmology, we have got this connection. Just as in cosmology, this object becomes just a scale factor, and this object becomes P sub A. So similarly, this connection becomes just a single variable, if you like C times some background triad. This is a background triad. You can fix, just like here also, we fix a background metric, the moving coordinates, we take background triad. And then the statement is that then, and similarly EA, I just as is represented just by one variable called P sub C, if you like. And then we actually do quantization. But we do quantization, that's the key point, that we do loop quantum cosmology with an eye to the full theory. Which means that we don't want to just consider square integral functions of C, as here we consider square integral functions of A, here we don't want to consider square integral functions of C as a Hilbert space, because the observables are going to be just again, holonomy and the fluxes. The flux turns out to be just P, but holonomy turns out to be equal to E to the I times some number times C. This is a real number. So holonomy is exponential. This is always exponential of the connection, and that is what happens. So this holonomy is not, so C itself is not a well-defined operator. Only these functions are called almost periodic because this is a real number, not an integer. So only these functions are actually, these are the observables. And you want to represent it, and again, you can repeat the last theorem argument. Initially, we just sort of intuitively followed what was happening, but in the last 2 years, there have been 3 or 4 papers which have really done, brought it down to loop quantum cosmology. You can just start with loop quantum cosmology, holonomy flux algebra, and then look for its representation subject to this diffeomorphism invariance constraint. The reason why we are talking about diffeomorphism invariance is that even after fixing gauge, as we do in loop quantum cosmology, there is still some diffeomorphism freedom left. These are large diffeomorphisms which are left. You ask for invariance under that, and that picks out a unique representation of this algebra. And in this representation, the wave functions are not square integral functions of this connection variable C, they're just different wave functions. So the statement is that, I mean, I can go into some detail, I'm running out of time. I can go into, namely, that you can actually get various, this is not this wave function, but actually you can construct a space, this holonomy flux algebra, and you can look at the Hilbert space, and you can represent these operators in terms of the operators in this Hilbert space explicitly, and see that this representation is inequivalent to the standard Schrodinger representation. So typical state in this representation is given just by finite linear combinations of these holonomies, which are, if you like, plane waves. They just give a finite linear, and these are normalizable with respect to this in this particular Hilbert space, which is completely well defined, which are not normalizable in the standard representation. So we get a new quantum mechanics. Ordinary, even at the level of ordinary quantum mechanics, there is a new quantum mechanics. You might see the surprise about what is happening in terms of X and P in ordinary quantum mechanics. Can I do this? Yes, we can do this. But then in these sectors, the operator X and P will not be well defined. It will only be the e to the I, lambda X, and P. Only these operators are well defined. X and P themselves are not well defined. And these representations were known also to many mathematical physicists beforehand. And this is what is happening. So there is a new kinematics. And now we look for new dynamics. Namely, we want to have this operator C hat F H on this particular kinematic in hyperspace, which is, let me call it, of almost periodic functions. And so that this is what we want to do. We want to consider this hyperspace up here of almost periodic functions. And now the statement is that you can do that, but of course you cannot look at copy what we did here, because here we are implicitly assuming square integral functions. Here they are not square integrable. So the Villard Evie differential operator is not well defined on this Hilbert space. And we need new tools. And the new tool is basically that in the constraint operator, there's a curvature, which is represented here by the curvature of the connection A. And the statement is that what classically we can do is we can represent this curvature by taking holonomy along a placket, divided by the area of this holonomy, and taking the limit as the area goes to zero. But in loop quantum cosmology, in loop quantum gravity, the area is a discrete spectrum, and so forth. There's a delicate interplay between what is happening in the full loop quantum gravity and what is happening in loop quantum cosmology, and you just by brute force say that they should match. If you actually do this matching, then the statement is that this FAB operator that you have got up here is going to be represented by limit. The area goes to the delta, where delta is the minimum non-zero area eigenvalue called the area gap. So the minimum area gap will be delta times Lp squared. So delta is a pure number. As delta goes to zero, this theory goes to the Villard Evie theory. But it's because delta is non-zero, then you find that this theory is not the standard Villard Evie theory. For example, you find explicitly, you can again construct the wave function. You can take a classical trajectory, take a wave function which is sharply peaked at it at late times, evolve it back in time, and you find that in fact this wave function bounces. So instead of going to singularity, it follows Einstein's equations very well until the curvature is about 1,000th of Planck curvature, and then our density is about 1,000th of then the Planck density, and then it bounces. Or you look at this operator rho hat, and you can look at these eigenvalues. And these eigenvalues have an upper bound. On the full physical Hilbert space. So no matter what state you take, the energy density in that state cannot exceed the value. And this upper bound is given by 18 pi upon delta q times rho Planck. And as you can see, just like for the hydrogen atom, if h bar goes to zero, the ground state energy goes to minus infinity. If h bar is usual value, it is minus 13.6. So here, the maximum energy density is this. As delta goes to zero, as you want to take the area gap to zero, we go back to Villard Evie theory. So this is the longest part, and this is what I have answered, namely that in fact you do have a bounce, and the physical observables, the Hilbert space, and the physical observables that we consider, which become singular in the classical theory, now attain Planck scale values, which are upper bound. So the third question there is a bounce determined by classical space-times, or is quantum physics essential? So I'm now talking about the third point there, and I finished the first two points in very briefly, very broad stroke picture of it. And now the third point up here. So is the bounds described in terms of classical? So the answer is no, quantum physics is essential. quantum geometry particularly is essential for this balance to happen. Both kinematics and dynamics have to be modified appropriately. But for states which are sharply peaked at late times, there are effective equations which can derive in a very systematic way using geometric quantum mechanics, which capture the leading order quantum corrections. We obtain effective equations. And these effective equations, for example, in place of the Friedmann equation, which says that the Hubble parameter squared is equal to 8 pi g, 3 times density, now you get a quantum correction. And the quantum correction is rho 1 minus so in fact the Hubble parameter vanishes when rho is equal to rho sup, and in the effective equation then this Hubble parameter vanishes, which means that a dot equal to 0, and that is where the bounce occurs. Similarly, the correction to the Rai-Chaudhuri equations but the statement is that these corrections are not incorporated in the. But the point is that these corrections are there, and, but these corrections do not change. They use the same continuity equation. The modifications are such they are obtained completely independently, but you obtain the same continuity equation as in general relativity. So there are consistent modifications in this particular set. This is a nice consistency check. So one shows that the Hubble, the density is bounded above, the Hubble parameter is bounded above, the in Bianchi models one shows that the shears are bounded above. There's a huge wealth of these results. Again, there's really, really a lot of work up here. There are several thousand papers, so I possibly cannot summarize it all. Okay. So the answer here is that yes, quantum physics is essential, but there are also these effective equations, which only for sharply fixed states, the states which are sharply peaked at late times remain sharply peaked as you come back close to the bounds, and the statement is that we obtain this is up here. Then the answer to the fourth question is there a new physics up here? So the fourth question was different. Conceptual and technical issues here. So let me start with this. Are there new conceptual and technical issues? So any time you start with some well-defined theory and not just change some potential or change some equation of state, but really have a full theory, and you actually have this kind of a bounce scenario, one of the things that you have to worry about is the following, that you have unleashed new effects, in this case, new quantum effects. These quantum effects are producing a repulsive force in the Planck regime, which bounces the universe. Then what we want to ask is the following. Is it true that these forces that we have, do they die off very quickly, or can their trace be remained for a long time, in which case it might violate something in the observations? So there is a examples of technical subtleties are basically there is a tension that you have to make sure is not there. So I should say potential tension between UV and IR. Do you get general relativity at low energy densities? This is a question that we want to ask, at least for states which are semi-class, which are sharply peaked at late time. And the statement up here is that this requires extreme care. In loop quantum cosmology, the whole bunch of us, I should say that the results I'm talking about here, of course, come from the whole community. They're not my results. Many of them were obtained by people in this room, but also there are other people, many, many other people. So, but here we need extreme care. And the statement is that in the beginning, the first thing that was done after realizing that we had this new kinematics, and then we tried to define the Hamiltonian constraint, there was a conceptual subtlety that was missed in the very beginning. It's a subtle point. It's a delicate point. It has to do with when we define the curvature operator, we're dividing by the area. Whose area? Now, in quantum cosmology, there is a fiducial metric, if you like, given by the co-moving coordinates. So the initially, we just divided by the area with respect to that fiducial metric. But then we got all kinds of results which were, I believe, not very physical. Namely, we got results such as, even for sharply peaked states, the density could occur, the bounce could occur at very low densities, like, you know, density of water. There are sharply peaked states in which this can happen. And there are also problems about certain gauge invariants which are not met, etc. But then we replace this by saying that, no, the quantum constraint operates on the state. The state defines a certain quantum geometry. Use the quantum geometry that is defined by that state. That's a physical geometry. So the area should be the physical area. And when we did this, there are three distinct problems which all went away at once. And in fact, we had this compatibility, this potential tension was resolved. I'm just mentioning this because it's a historical thing that happened 10 years ago, but still is something that is important to talk about. Yeah.
Maybe this is for much later, but I'm just intrigued that this quantum effect would give you a minus sign. The only place I've ever seen that is with the exchange forces, with fermions.
Right. So you're talking about this minus sign.
Yeah.
That's really so the statement is that really it is really this, the fact that the area, this flux lines of, heuristically, the flux lines of this area, they are quantized. And you cannot pack too many of these flux lines, if you like. It's a little bit like type 2B superconductor. This is only mathematical analogy. Just like these flux lines are repelled from a type 2B superconductor, type 2 superconductor, these are repelled here.
So
it's like the Meissner effect. But the statement is that here, it is coming out of quantum geometry. And that is, and these flux lines that we're talking about are the dual of the flux lines. There it is magnetic fields, and here it is like the electric field. Okay. Then let me talk about, so this is one example. The second potential example that is interesting is this entropy bounce. So, I mean, there are many entropy bounds, but some of them are just not viable, and people have looked at it. But one which is sort of taken very seriously and which passes many, many tests is the Busso bound. And what it says is the following, that suppose you look at light sheets, so given any surface up here, you look at the light sheet, so this surface is called B, and then this is called light sheet of this B. And then you define, so this is all, we want to define the entropy associated with this B up here. So, the idea is that if you have fluid description, you have notion of entropy current. So you look at the flux of the entropy current up here, and you just define SB to be integral on this light sheet of the area. This is a three surface, so I know. Let me call it ABA. The volume element, if you like, associated with this thing. So we just calculate this, and so the flux of entropy current across this surface up here. And then the conjecture is that this SB should be less than or equal to area of B divided by 4LP squared. That is the conjecture. Okay. And now this conjecture has been looked at in many, many cases. And in the classical regime, it is actually satisfied. But it's very peculiar. It needs three elements which seem peculiar. One is that you need to talk about entropic current. If you just have fundamental field description, it's not obvious what the entropy current should be. The perfect fluid description, we know what it is. Then there is also, there is a Planck length coming here, so we also need quantum gravity. But at the same time, we ought to define this light sheet. So we therefore need sharp geometry, pseudo-Riemannian geometry, to define the light sheet. So it's a funny thing that is happening up here. But many people, including Busso particularly, feel that this is a fundamental thing, and any quantum gravity theory should have built-in principle from which this emerges. Now, we are lucky in loop quantum cosmology, because even though the phenomena really is happening because we've got quantum geometry, we just saw that there is an effective description, and this effective description gives us a metric which is effective. In this case, whatever symmetries you have, Friedman, Robertson, Walker, or Bianchi models, or Gaudi models, which are inhomogeneities, you'll get an effective metric like that. And therefore, which is sort of, the wave function is sharply peaked along this effective geometry. Therefore, we have quantum gravity, but we also have an effective geometry. And in cosmological context, we can use, for example, in the case of a radiation-dominated universe, we can use the entropic current by using the perfect fluid description up here. So these three things which are needed are actually met in quantum cosmology, and we can again ask what happens here about for this entropy bound. And we find that the entropy bound in a loop quantum cosmology, with you calculate any surface, any round surface, because then only round, right? Ed and I did this. So we looked at only round surfaces, and we calculated this, and we find that this is less than equal to something like 0.97 times AB upon 4LP squared in loop quantum cosmology. But in GR, if we just take GR, then this bound is violated. Arbitrarily violated, completely violated in the Planck regime. In loop quantum cosmology, at the bounds, near the bounds, we are in the Planck regime, and still it is not. So we find this, but the conclusion that the more important conclusion that I draw from this is the following. We did not have a built-in principle in loop quantum gravity or loop quantum cosmology which looked for entropy violation or something like that. I mean, it may be something implicit, but explicitly, it was not really put there to say that we should have boundedness of entropy, that this law should be built into the fundamental principles. And yet, this result emerges, and therefore this result is really not enough. It emerges just in the effective description automatically, without any input. So my view is that the fact that these things require all this funny mixture of things is a strong indication that there is really, this is, does not have a role to play in the fundamental theory, and it comes up. There is a third point that I want to say, make, but I will not, maybe will, because I've included it because Neil will be most interested in it. It has to do with inflation and, so to say, probability and such thing, but maybe in a discussion period that we can talk about this. So let me just come to the last part and very quickly about observational
tests. So just a quick technical point. There was a free parameter delta you had up there and then disappeared down here.
Very good. Thank you. I want to make it. Very good. So the statement is that very, very good. So there's a consistency. The delta up here is the same as so the statement is that, so this is a consistency between the two. So we got this delta as a free parameter, but you do the black hole calculation, where again, it's a completely different calculation, where you've got an ensemble of punctures and various other things that we do, and not in loop quantum cosmology, but in full loop quantum gravity. That fixes the delta, and with that delta, this is what happens. So there is a very nice consistency between the two things. Thank you. Now, last thing I just want to say is observational test. And this is the thing that we'll hear much more about probably from Orlia, from Ivan, sorry, forgetting your name, Ivan and other speakers up here. I just wanted to mention why there can be observational prediction, observational ramifications of these things. What we saw here is the following. We have a quantum geometry, but it's well described by some effective geometry in some ways. And now what happens is that the first thing that we have developed, this was with Laudowski and Kaminsky, we extended quantum field theory on the Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker background to quantum field theory. These are just test fields on quantum Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker geometries. So we got these quantum geometries, these wave functions for the background. So we don't have a single geometry, but we got a probability distribution of these geometries. So at first it looks completely hopeless, but this was done 5 years, 8 years ago. This is quantum field theory in this is developed. Therefore, what we can do is we can look at perturbations. Perturbations, cosmological perturbations, are really described by normally by taking a Friedman Lemaître Robertson Walker background and looking at linearized perturbations on them. But here we can evolve those quantum fields representing perturbations on this quantum geometry up here. So that's what we do. We evolve, we can do that. And now then the question is, what is going to happen in general? So you remember that the key factor up here is always what is the wave, physical wavelength of perturbations compared to the curvature radius. In the perturbation equation, you always add this k squared and then the curvature, or if you like, the k physical compared to curvature, scalar curvature, the four-dimensional scalar curvature of the Friedman-Lemaître Walker. If in fact the wavelength is much less than, or is less than, curvature radius, then in fact these perturbations propagate as though they're in flat space. You don't even feel the curvature. And now the usual assumption is that prior to inflation, all the observable modes, that the modes which are observable in the CMB now, all those modes had wavelength which is shorter than the curvature radius, and therefore they propagated as though they were in Minkowski space. But what we find up here is the following. Go back all the way to the bounds, okay, throughout the Planck regime. Now, if I went back to the Big Bang instead of the bounds, then at the Big Bang, the curvature diverges. Therefore, the curvature radius is infinite. And therefore, you would think that, well, at least all the modes could have been in the curvature radius, right, all the way from the Big Bang up to the time they exit the Hubble horizon at the onset of inflation. But in our case, this curvature radius is finite.
Can you just be a little bit more precise?
Sure,
please.
That. Oh, yeah. Okay.
But the
Ritchie
scan is zero, or radiation
dominated. No, this is not radiation dominated. This is supposed to be the inflation.
Radiation dominated.
Right. Okay.
Radius is zero.
So very good. So if you take
infinite, according to this, I'm not sure what this definition is.
Right. So the statement is that I'm saying that yeah. So it is true that in that case, if you look at the wave equation satisfied by the tensor perturbations, for example, they propagate as though they are in flat space. Because the curvature radius is zero. I mean, the equation is, I'll always get things mixed up, so signs and so on mixed up. So the equation looks like d eta chi k plus a squared of eta times k squared upon a squared of eta. And then the statement is that so this is the curvature, and this is the physical, k physical. If this is zero, this is the curvature, scalar curvature. So if this is zero, then I just get the equation for these modes. This a squared cancels out, I get the mode.
These supposed to be the tensor modes?
Yeah, these will be the tensor modes, for example.
But entire order, of course, you can
yeah,
each
Yeah, sure. This is just a test field approximation that is used in the usual thing. So this will go away, and this looks like Minkowski space propagation. Okay, but now what happens is, let me come back to loop quantum gravity. So in loop quantum gravity, so if here if I plot lengths, and here I plot time, so in loop quantum gravity, the curvature radius is finite. Let me put it here, it's finite up here. And it grows, and at curvature radius grows, curvature falls, and at inflation it becomes constant up here. But now, this is not, so the curvature radius is fine, it's not infinite. And therefore, I can have modes which actually at the bounds, so these are the bounds. So this is t equal to 0 is the bounds up here. So I can have more which at in the Planck domain near the big bounds or slightly prior to the big bounds is actually has radius up here which is has a wavelength up here which is larger than the curvature radius. And then it expands and then it can enter the, I And then it again exits the Hubble horizon during inflation up here. So this is lambda physical. So if the curvature, if the wavelength is actually larger than the curvature radius, these bodes will be excited. And therefore, when they exit the Hubble horizon, or just before they exit the Hubble horizon, they will not be in the Bunch Davis vacuum. And because they are not in Bunch Davis vacuum, you can have new effects. Now, originally people had thought that maybe not being in Bunch Davis vacuum would just mean that these effects would be there, but they'll be diluted away by the inflation. But a very nice work by Parker and Aguillo has shown that this is not the case, and Navarro Salas have shown that this is not the case, because if in fact there are excitations at the onset of inflation, then there's also stimulated emission, so that the density of this excitation remains constant. And therefore, they could actually have observable consequences. Now, whether this does happen or does not happen depends on all kinds of things, and I think we'll hear more about this in this talk by Aguillo. Thank you.
Comments. So this figure that you drew is a figure that appears in many effective models of lamps. So
yeah, this figure is not new.
And secondly,
but the reason for this value coming up and the precise scale that is coming out is coming from Luponi.
The second thing is the equation that you are looking at here is the equation of the test field, which gives you the evolution of gravitational waves, not the evolution of scalar cosmological perturbations. And it's well known that actually the slope of the scalars and tensors
So I first wanted, because you have raised this question before, so I wanted to do this, but there's just not time. So the statement for the gravitational waves, there's also a potential term that is coming up here. And then you have to estimate what that potential term is. It does change the slope, but you have to estimate that potential term is. But that potential term is very small in Luponi cosmology, all the way from the bounds up to the onset of inflation. And of course, during inflation, it's very small. So we should, yeah.
Quick question. I mean, your classical effective equation for the bounds, what worries me most about it, it doesn't seem to be generally covariant.
Sorry?
It does not seem to be generally covariant,
yeah,
that
good
equation.
So one of the questions that's a very good question. So, I mean, one test is this continuity equation, which is coming up here. So one of the questions is whether this could come from a generally covariant theory or this is something else. And therefore, in fact, when Param Singh was here, he and Olemo wrote down an action. It's an action with higher derivative terms, infinitely many higher derivative terms, which in the cosmological sector reduces to this. So it does not seem that, but they have actually written that this.
So it requires some kind of non-local.
It requires non-local. And that is not very surprising, because this the way that we are defining this curvature, if you like, is really non-local, because we are taking this area to be the minimum area. So a curvature is defined in terms of holonomies, which says that I'm going to have, in the limit I'll get curvature, but then there's first correction, the quadratic, second. So there'll be all these corrections. So it's compatible, but this is something that is not, I mean, we're not looked at, whether, what they concluded also was that there is not a unique action which will give you this, there are many other actions which give you this, and therefore that's the reason why people are not followed up so much on that action of full theory. But it's a good thing to actually look at.
So, but when you then make statements about the Busso bound being respected, then obviously the formulation of the Busso bound is covariant, and so, but the equations are not, and so presumably this becomes coordinate dependent, whether or not you satisfy the Busso bound.
No, the statement is that
on the other blackboard behind.
Yeah,
you explain.
Right.
So
it is covariant, I agree. So I'm calculating that quantity, right? I'm calculating that quantity in the effective geometry.
But you have to use some particular coordinate system, because this is.
Once I get the geometry in the coordinate systems, right? And then I just have that as a metric. It's true that I define first the metric in some coordinate system, just like what we do in Friedman, Robertson-Walker, right? And then I got a four metric, and we ask, is everything covariant with respect to that four metric? And the statement here is the same. The statement is that there's an effective metric, GAB effective, which is actually, four metric. Once I got that four metric, and I just use that four metric in order to do this Busso bound thing. But that four metric does not satisfy Einstein's equations. It satisfies Einstein's equations to great accuracy at late times, but near the bounds, the Planck regime, I should say, it does not satisfy that. And that is when the bound was actually violated in the Planck regime. And the statement here is that it is true throughout the the entire history. So just to one line summary is really that that in loop quantum cosmology, people have really worked very hard 10 years ago for really getting a precise mathematical framework so that there is a Hilbert space, there are operators, there are bounds, and we look variable. There are situations in which this operator C hat H is not essentially self-adjoint. It admits multiple self-adjoint extensions. For example, when the cosmology of constant is positive. Then we have looked at every self-adjoint extension of this operator and then worked out what happens, what is true, what is not true. And it has even suggested a conjecture for mathematics that my mathematics, the friends in operator algebra, were not aware of, and so they're thinking about it. So people, this really has been done carefully. And then the statement is that after all that is done, it is because that there is a new length scale that is coming up, which is really the radius of curvature and the bounds. That length scale is what is giving rise to opening a window to the Planck data. The Planck people themselves have said in paper 16, I think, that these anomalies that they find may be a window into the very, you know, the new quantum phenomena that have not been found. And I think people like Aguirre are looking at this in great detail. Thank you.